Labor conference will now come to order. It's 3:20 p.m. on April 4th, 2016. With us, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tolton, Representative Hughes, Representative Joseph, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones. We've been joined by Representative Vasquez in the audience. Three items on the calendar. First up is Senate Bill 125. And I believe it'll be presented by the sponsor and Weston Eiler as well. Please join us. And we've been joined by Representative Culver.
Thank you.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have our undivided attention. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mia Costello. I serve in the State Senate representing District K in Anchorage. And today before you is Senate Bill 125. This is a bill that strengthens and diversifies the board of directors for the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, otherwise known as AGDC. As you know, AGDC is the state's primary representative in the AKLNG project and will be the focal point for significant policy decisions in the coming years. The bill will facilitate communication and a teamwork approach between the board and the legislature to help move the AKLNG project forward. I believe the best way to make these decisions is to give all parties a seat at the table. The bill before you adds three legislators as non-voting members to the board, one from the Senate, one from the House, and one from either minority caucus. The bill also helps ensure the original intent of the legislature is reflected in the board's composition. It would reserve four out of the five public seats on the board for appointees with expertise in natural gas, pipeline construction, finance, project management, or other experience relevant to the duties. Mr. Chair, the importance of the gas line project is well known to Alaskans and members of this body. Having legislators on a board as important as AGDC is an asset. Legislators as ex officio non-voting members will provide perspective, institutional knowledge, and continuity. The members also have an opinion from Ledge Legal before you that's related to relevant case law that state courts around the country are split. And I want to point you to a memo from Emily Newman where it says that given the split in how other states treat non-voting legislative members, perhaps nothing can be relied upon to divine the outcome of this state. Supreme Court of South Carolina, the South Carolina Public Interest Foundation versus South Carolina Infrastructure Bank in 2013 upheld legislators having an ex officio role on state boards and commissions. The fact that the legislators would serve as non-voting members, in my estimation, alleviates these constitutional concerns in addition to the memo you've seen. And there is precedent for having legislators serve and advise on state boards. Legislators currently serve on a dozen state boards and commissions, including state corporations: the Kinnick Armbridge Authority, the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. I also want to mention the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, the Alaska Healthcare Commission, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board, and ASME. And we've heard from legislators who have served on some of these boards saying that their involvement in the board and listening and being non-voting ex officio members has been described as an asset to those members who do vote on the board. This bill will improve collaboration and communication on the project by strengthening and diversifying the board, and I urge your support, and I'd like to turn it over to my aide, Weston Eiler, for further discussion of the bill.
Welcome back, Weston. Please read yourself onto the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Eiler, staff to Senator Mia Costello. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to walk through a sectional analysis of the bill, just outlining the provisions. Members should also have this in your packet. Section 1 of the bill as a member of the House appointed by the Speaker, and a member of the Senate appointed by the Senate President, and a member of the Minority Caucus jointly appointed by the presiding officers to as non-voting members of the AGDC Board, taking the number of board members from 7 to 10. Section 2, Mr. Chairman, requires that four of the five public seats on the AGDC Board be filled by appointees who have qualifications in natural gas, pipeline construction, operations, marketing, large project management, and other expertise and experience relevant to the operations of AGDC. This is inserted to ensure that the legislature's intention in the enacting of Senate Bill 138 in 2014 to enable the advancement of a gas pipeline project is maintained. Section 3 states that legislative members of the board may not be reimbursed or compensated by the corporation for their service on the board and related costs. Section 4 of the bill, under the meetings of the board section of statute, specifies that legislative members may participate in all board activities except for voting. They may not be barred from or excluded from executive session, and they also may not be appointed for a term longer than 2 years. Section 5 and 6 are conforming languages, clarifying voting members of the board as opposed to members of the board. Those conforming changes are also in Section 7, 8, 9, and an immediate effective date in Section 11. That's a brief overview of the sectional, Mr. Chairman, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Weston?
Yes.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your name again is Weston? Okay.
Yes.
Through the chair for Weston, I guess. There's an AG opinion of March 20th that refers to the AGDC as an executive branch entity. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out in part is the table that's included in this packet from your office. Are these agencies, or rather these boards, starting with the Aerospace Corporation and ending with the Suicide Council, are those executive branch agencies, or are they some other creature of the government?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I would want to confer with Council Legislative Legal about the definition that you're speaking to, but I think the short answer is both. What you have on this list, again, this was compiled by our office, is basically a variety of capacities in which the legislature, through kind of ex officio non-voting members, interacts and advises aspects of the functions of the administration, whether that be through commissions, whether that be through kind of more independent state corporations such as the Aerospace Board, Kinnick Arm Bridge, whether it be or basically just divisions that are off of state government. The Department of Commerce is a good example, with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute Board and the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board. So within this list, I think you have a variety of types of agencies, advisory committees, and other functions by which the legislature is advising the administration and the overall process of state government.
Follow-up?
No.
Representative Ledoux.
So I'm just trying to figure out whether or not there are any boards and commissions that we serve on as legislators which are identical legally to the structure of the AGDC. I mean that they're legally the same kind of corporation. Like, I served on the board a long time ago of Alaska Aeronautical Development Corporation. So is that kind of the same legal entity, same type of legal entity as the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'd be happy to put together kind of a side-by-side in terms of their authorization and the type of structure that they have in statute, but I think What you've highlighted is there's a great deal of similarities, yes. These are state corporations, whether it be the Aerospace Board, whether it be the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, that are kind of very large projects, and they are technically state corporations. Their legislators are serving in a non-voting ex officio manner on boards of directors, not just as an advisory commission or another state board. These are actually institutions and set up with a board to make business decisions on behalf of, you know, state, private, public partnerships.
Thank you.
Follow up, new question?
So, yes, new question. So I'm seeing this memo from Jerry Jude, and then there's another memo from Don Bullock, I think. Is there a third memo out there somewhere, too?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, primarily what Senator Costello had highlighted, and I think I might be able to clear that up, is a memo from Legislative Legal dated March 30th of 2016 from Emily Nauman, Legislative Counsel, to Representative Mike Chenault, attention Don Bullock, in his capacity as a member of Speaker Chenault's staff. So that is the Legislative Legal memo that we're referring to in presentation of the bill.
Thank you.
Could I? Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair for Weston. There was another memo on December the 7th last year, and I talked about this in the previous committee of referral. In that memo, Ms. Nauman concluded that the proposal was likely not constitutional. Last week, she said it may not be constitutional. One difference I highlighted was that in the previous memo, the December 7th memo, she expressly says, in her defense, she says, well, I'm not speaking to non-voting membership here. But I guess, unfortunately, I don't have the memos with me. But do you know, other than that, why she moved from a likely not constitutional to a may not be constitutional sort of legal analysis?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, and if I might make sure I understand your question correctly, if I've heard you correctly, that, you know, certainly that voting legislative members mm-hmm. might be in conflict, and that was the subject of an earlier legislative legal memo?
Well, yes. So if I may clarify. So essentially, legislative lawyers on the 7th of December were inclined to say this proposal, broadly speaking, is not consistent with the Constitution. Last week, the same attorney said, well, it may very well be consistent with the Constitution. And I'm asking whether you know what the difference is.
And through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'd be happy to follow up with you and your staff. What I heard you say, and perhaps there's your previous alleged legal opinion that we can look at, that, again, what I heard from your question is that certainly voting legislative members would run into conflict with regards to the constitutional issues. With regards to kind of clarifying Ledge Legal's opinion, page 4 of the memo that was issued, again, on March 30th, and I'll just, if I might, Mr. Chairman, just briefly summarize and read the sentence of the last paragraph, states, quote, what is clear is that the issue of non-voting legislative members on executive branch boards is unsettled. It goes on to then say that I do not believe the risk is great enough that I would advise removing the legislative board members from the bill. Representative Josephson, I'd be happy to follow up and we can look at the documents that you might be referring to. I don't have them.
Okay.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I guess I was just wondering, rather than try to figure out why Ms. Nauman might have changed her mind, I mean, is she online to answer questions?
No.
Can she be here?
Yeah, we can take them at ease and see if we can get her. At ease. Emily Nauman, I believe, is online, so who wants to restate the question to her? Are you there, Emily?
Yes, I am here.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. We have a couple of questions regarding your March 30th memo. Who would like to? Representative Andy Josephson is going to address it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Nellman, through the chair, you wrote a memo on, I guess, a broad proposal. I don't know if there had been a drafted bill on the 7th of December. And you said that in a fairly long memo, you said it wasn't likely constitutional for there to be legislative members. And then last week you wrote one saying it may not be. And I was curious if you could tell the committee why you went from a likely not position to a may not be position.
Sure. Through the chair, this is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal. And I think that Mr. Eiler started to answer your question, but on the December 7th memo, if you'll flip to the last page, page 3, I noted that the ex officio members may possibly reduce the infringement on the executive branch powers, thereby potentially lessening the constitutional issues. The bulk of the December 7th memo was written about legislative members serving on the AGDC board that would be voting and participate in some of the officer selection, et cetera. The March 30th memo explicitly deals with the possibility of legislative members as ex officio or non-voting members. It's my opinion that non-voting members may not, basically, that we need a court opinion to know for certain whether or not non-voting legislative members are unconstitutional.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Nauman, the Attorney General's opinion relies on a 1968 decision from the state of Alaska and a 1976 decision from the state of Alaska and several AGO opinions. And it's my understanding that Attorney General's opinions are law until they're not. That is, they're presumptively law. You don't rely as much on state opinions as sort of an overall jurisprudential analysis. Is that fair?
That's correct. And I don't believe that there is an AG's opinion explicitly about non-voting legislative members on boards and commissions.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ledoux, any questions? Nope. Representative Kito.
Thank you. And a question, I think, for Senator Costello or Mr. Eiler. So I'm trying to understand the need for having legislative participation on this particular board. And I'm thinking that at this point, every one of the members of the legislature has the ability to go to an AGDC meeting. We all have the ability to receive information from AGDC, and if we're not going to have members from our body have the ability to vote, what is the impact or the role of their participation on the AGDC board?
Thank you, Representative Kito, through the chair. You know, the state of Alaska is facing incredible fiscal challenges. And the gas line project is what I've termed as the bright shining star on our horizon. The impact that this project will have on our state's future is immense. Currently, 6 of the 7 board members have exchanged in the last year. I mean, we have incredible turnover. And members of the legislature were here in the creation of many of the pieces of legislation that are guiding the project as we speak. It is true that we are invited to the meetings, but they often will go into executive session. And during those executive sessions, we're not privy to what the discussion is. Considering the impact of the project and its scope, the types of decisions that will be made, I see this as no different than having 2 legislators, and we're asking for 3, to sit on the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute board or the Alaska, Travel Industry Association or board or marketing board or any of these other corporations that we currently have members sitting on. And, you know, I'm a parent, as are you, and I can't get over the fact in some manner that there are more kids on my 11-year-old soccer team than we have on the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation team sitting in that room for those meetings. I think, and I've spoken to the governor about the intention of the bill is to foster communication and cooperation and trust amongst those of us, which is all of Alaska. You know, we are the people's branch. And I believe that the people deserve to be in the room listening and advising as we move forward with this project.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess if it's a concern about being involved in an executive session or a concern about continuity, I guess we have had a discussion in the past about qualifications of the board members and making sure that they do have qualifications that fit the type of project we're working on. And we are lay legislators, so I do have a background in engineering. I don't have a background in pipelines. But I would not presume to understand, at least at a detailed technical level, what is going on in a gas filtration plant or a liquefaction plant or a pipeline. And if I am the person trying to be the member for continuity, but I'm not an expert in any of those fields, I would be concerned that I'm providing advice that might set some of those members off in the wrong direction if they're new members and they are members that have expertise in those areas. So I am concerned that we're relying on lay legislators like ourselves that might not have technical expertise in natural gas pipelines to be that continuity. And I'm also thinking that if there are questions from the board about what the impacts or what the implications are of decisions that they make on the legislature, they would be able to call legislators in and say, you know, we're going through, this is a decision, we'd like to ask you that question. It seems like that's a reasonable thing to do. I do guess not completely understand that when we have a legislative member going into executive session, those members, those three individuals, would not be able to come out and talk to anybody else. They could only talk to each other and other members of the board. So what is the benefit of those individuals being in those executive sessions on a regular basis? So I guess I didn't get the answer to the first question, which is what is the role of these individuals? If it is only that they'd be able to go into executive session or provide continuity, those are concerns that I've already expressed. If it is that they can participate in the executive sessions, I'm curious as to at what level they participate, because the information that they gain in executive sessions are not coming back out of that executive session.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I mean, certainly either you agree, I guess, with the premise of the bill, which is the people's branch has a seat at the table, no matter if that table is inside a locked door or outside in the public view. It's my, as the author of the legislation putting it forward, it's my belief that we do have a value in being there. And so I think in some ways it's just a question that you have to ask yourself when you vote on any bill. In terms of the value, the legislature did pass Senate Bill 138, which is the guiding structure for the entire project. So certainly based on that alone, we have individuals who worked on that legislation and I think would be very excited at the opportunity to be a part of listening and discussing during those meetings.
I'm going to speak only for myself, but I think I'm probably speaking for other members. There is some concern of the current structure of the board now, where the primarily the majority of the members, their only experience is having been on the Alaska Gasline Port Authority board, which was around for I believe 15-16 years and never really had any traction. And that's it. I mean, we had a guy on the original board that had 30-35 years of gasline experience, had brought online the biggest gasline project in the world or one of the largest,
has been retired for 8 or 10 years and divested himself of all stock or anything related to the oil industry, and lived in Alaska part of the year and was rejected because he wasn't an Alaskan. We had Drew Pierce, who I believe was the federal gas line coordinator for a number of years, so I would assume, and not only that, had a lot of legislative experience as well, that was not considered to be an Alaskan because she was living in Washington, D.C. That to me would be like our two senators and our congressmen living in D.C. and not being Alaska residents. But I think that is one of the reasons that we want to see some people on the board, because the direction that it may be going may not be the direction that was envisioned by the bulk of the people that got the ball rolling. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. I'm not exactly sure where I stand on parts of the bill. The one part of the bill I really like is requiring the expertise and experience. That's been troubling to me with the recent replacements. As far as the non-voting members, I understand there are other boards in the state that have them. But I have a question, because, first of all, I'm wondering about the nature of the executive sessions, because they have to have some reason they go into executive session. Sometimes it's a human resource type of thing. And I was wondering, do you have a sense or a rundown of why they've gone into executive session and the general content of what it is, whether it's a human resource matter or something else?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, and I'd partially defer to AGDC about kind of the nature of their executive sessions. Certainly AGDC is exempt from many parts of the Administrative Procedures Act except for open meetings. So with that, I think you highlighted several of them, personnel or others, but kind of the nature and kind of the limits on where they call and kind of what, you know, mandates or what prompts that, I think, is primarily a question for AGDC.
And follow up with, well, it's really, I guess it's kind of a new question. I'm wondering if the bill sponsor can assure me, we want this board to be apolitical. Now, is anything apolitical? I'm not sure anything is. But can you provide some reassurance to me that if we had non-voting members on this, that it wouldn't make it even more political than some of us think maybe it has become more recently?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, the legislature votes on the appointment of all the other, most of the board members, and except for the commissioners that are on the AGDC board. You and I both represent people in our districts, and I think the philosophical discussion about whether something's political or not, I think politics ends up in a lot of things. And this is our largest project, and I would like to see the people's branch be represented there. Whether you see that as political is, I guess, an opinion. I see it as only adding value to the board and adding some depth in terms of the history of the legislation, the history of the project.
And follow up?
Follow up.
Yeah, and I could, an argument might be made, too, that it could provide some balance if it does get political one way or the other. I have another question, Mr. Chair, if it's okay.
Certainly.
Just wondering if you're confident that those serving on the AGDC board, if they were to go into executive session, would be as free and open and able to discuss things in a way that needs to happen for the best in the best interest of Alaskans with legislature serving. In other words, will they hold back? Will they hesitate? Will they be free to really lay things out on the table in the same way with legislators in the room or not in the room? Can you assure us in that regard of just your sense?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I believe that those people who are interested in serving and feel that they could follow the guidelines and the, the procedures for how that would be handled would be those people that put their name forward. And for those who don't feel comfortable, then I would not recommend putting your name forward to the leadership in the House.
I think Representative Joseph.
Yeah, just want to
just follow.
Yeah, just follow. I just want to thank you for that. I do believe that we're professionals and that can happen. And I just wanted to hear it from the bill sponsor. Thank you very much,
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Costello, what kind of quid pro quo exists in the law where executive branch officials can listen to our executive sessions? Are they always welcome to an LBA executive session? Do you know whether there's that reciprocity? I don't know, and that's why I'm asking.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I'd prefer if somebody else with more experience with that in that matter answer that question.
I don't know if Ms. Nauman is still on the phone.
I don't know. I'm on LBNA, and I can't recall there ever being a request. But Emily, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Do you need the question repeated?
I believe that I heard it through the chair to Representative Josephson. Again, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. I'm not aware of any law that allows a member of the executive branch to sit in on a legislative committee,
Paula? Yes. Ms. Nauman, are you in a position based on experience and you know, longevity there, if you have much, I don't know how long you've been there, would you have been exposed to such a law if it existed? In other words, would you have heard that as water cooler talk, or are you confident that no such law exists?
I'm thinking, excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I've never come across a law like that for as long as I've been working. I've never heard of a law like that.
Okay. Can I follow up? It's actually sort of new, but through the chair, for Senator Costello, these other commissions and boards, do we know whether there's ever been a challenge brought by a member of the community to claim that there was an improper practice of allowing legislators on boards? And I see the Aerospace Board and the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, which I guess doesn't really exist in the same way, as being more akin to this than the others.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, not that I am aware.
Okay. Thank you.
It's just come to my attention that Commissioner Fisher was invited to the last Ledge Council executive session, but declined since the governor did not want him to participate, is what I've been told. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On, I guess, my limited experience on Legislative Council and LBNA, the committees have the ability to invite any individual, but those individuals don't have a right to participate in executive session unless invited.
Well, I think that'd be the same as us being able to go. I can go to Ledge Council executive sessions, and I'm not on it. Any member of the House or the Senate can, but we can't participate, I believe. Representative, who's next? Ledoux.
Well, I just wanted to see whether there was going to be somebody from the administration here to testify that this is not a good idea, because I'm seeing the legal aspects of this. It could go either way.
Darlene Peterson, are you here to testify or just to listen?
So I guess I'm not sure, because I was on the board of AG of the aerospace board. And so before this bill started out, and somebody was telling me that there's an opinion that says this is illegal, I said, well, how could it be illegal? Because I served 4 years on the aerospace board. So I guess I'm not sure how helpful this bill may be to the legislature. But I'm not sure, on the other hand, since we do serve on other boards, how it would be a bad idea either. And it looks like there's nobody to tell me that it's a bad idea, so it must be a good idea.
Yeah, I think it was a bad idea they'd send somebody down here to testify. And we could probably squeeze Darwin, but I'd probably lose a friend out of it. Any further questions? Any questions that weren't related to the last topic? Any general questions? Then I think we'll open it up to public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? Representative Vasquez.
Just quickly, I haven't totally briefed this. For the record, Representative Liz Vasquez. I represent District 22, which is West Anchorage, and I haven't totally had an opportunity to research this entire issue, but the committee should keep in mind that this board is set up as not part of the executive branch subject reporting directly to the governor. It is set up as an independent corporation to the extent that it is exempt from all personnel or procurement regulations and statutes that pertain to the rest of the state. The only thing it needs to comply with from reading the statute is the open meetings law. So I find that even if there's a legal opinion that states, and I don't think you can point to a definitive legal decision rendered in a court of the state, but even if you were to find an opinion, which it doesn't exist, it would probably discuss an identity that's closer to the executive branch or within the executive branch, and this is totally distinct. So it empowers what I would say it supports this bill. Any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Who's next? Seeing nobody in the room, is there anybody online? With that, we will close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. What are the wishes of the Representative Colbert?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is kind of an area that we've seen a lot of activity in, boards and commissions and the dual officer provisions of the Constitution. We've had a couple of these bills. So the same legal opinions basically apply when you put a legislator on a constitutional board. My main concern is that, you know, with this constitutional issue outstanding, we may subject board actions by the ADGC to litigation by those that may not be happy with the outcome of board decisions. So my concern is more to that we may cloud business that we expect ADGC to do. If we could do this, and I was real comfortable with the constitutionality, I wouldn't have concerns. But Constitution Article 2, Section 5, prohibition on holding dual office, no legislator may hold any other office or position of profit under the United States or the state. That's in our Constitution. And I thought AGGC was supposed to look like a business, act like a business, and I don't know how much business you could get done if we bog them down with politics. So I guess that's the concerns I have. I'm not saying I'm going to try to hold the bill in committee or anything. I think we'll let the whole House vote on it. But I have some concerns that I think that we may put in jeopardy decisions by the board should we do this.
I think I can save the sponsor a trip up to the table, but we have at least a dozen other boards, similar boards, and to the best of my knowledge, we've never had that issue arise with ASME or the Rocket Board and Kodiak and the rest of them. I think if they had, we'd all know about it because we'd all be involved. But I don't think that's going to be an issue.
But then again, I think you're right. It probably does need to go to the floor. Any further comments? Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm thinking in terms of what we are trying to accomplish with this, and I do think we do have a board that seems to be operating. I don't see the benefit of adding three additional members to the board, especially members that will change every 2 years. So while there was the comment about trying to have continuity of the members, they are not appointed for more than 2 or 3 years at a time, which is maybe more often than the boards. We've seen some changes in this year, but we change legislatures every 2 years, which means there will be new appointments to this board every 2 years. So I don't know where the continuity comes from. So I do think it's at this point not necessary, and I don't know that I can support this activity or this action.
Any further comments? Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we had this in resources on Friday, and I've actually, it may not sound it by what I'm going to say, may not sound like it by what I'm going to say, but I've actually sort of changed my perspective a little bit more and slightly more in terms of the sponsor of the bill. However, I still have some concerns, and those concerns are the memos written by our legal cite to other states. Those are called persuasive authority. That means that if there's a vacuum or void and you have no other authority, the court can look at that and say, well, I'm going to pluck one out of Arkansas or Texas. But here, the Attorney General cites to actual state authority on dual office holding and separation of powers. And even though those decisions are dated, they're as good of law as if they were written yesterday. There's also three AGO opinions that sort of buttress and support that. I do, as I said in the previous committee, I do have concerns with the turnover. And I recall when Richard Rabinow was nominated by Governor Parnell for this, I came incredibly close, though didn't vote for him because he had enormous background, mostly working for Exxon Pipeline. And I see the merit of that. On the other hand, during the latter years of the Parnell administration, there were debates about what the law says relative to appointing someone who was not an Alaskan. And that was pretty unclear to me. I remember at the time thinking that the governor was wrong and that you had to, without a change of the law, you had to be an Alaskan for most of these assignments. I'm concerned a little bit about the politicizing of the agency. I'm concerned about I don't quite understand. I see some benefit in appointed persons talking in executive session or in public session and saying, look, this is what you need to understand about the legislature that you're missing in terms of appropriations and funding, for example. But they couldn't share executive session comments with any of us. And I think that I mostly rely on my concern with my own oath and the constitutionality question. I also thought Representative Culver made some good points about the possibility of litigation and leaving the board to do the business of operating operating this corporation. So, even though I would concede the point that there's no ruling on all fours, as they say, that is just absolutely on point, there's enough from the Bradner decision and the Begich decision that I think that I sort of see where the courts would go with this. So I'm a no vote.
Any further comments? Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I just want to say I again appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. I do find it curious, as Representative Ledoux said, that neither the administration or anyone from AGDC seems to have weighed in today. And I'm going to keep thinking about this. I don't see any reason to keep it from committee. And be perfectly honest, if it passes, I don't believe that it will be harmful in the way that some might think. I serve on the Tourism Marketing Board, and I find my expertise is more about the process here in this building and helping them understand what's going on. And I'm not offering travel and tourism expertise that they bring to the table. So I think that it could be a good working relation and improved communications, and I believe that professionals would be around the table and that it could work well, Mr. Chair, so I have no problem with it moving from committee.
I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 125 version 29-L S1250 back S from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
And I'll object.
Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Tilton?
Yes.
Representative Tito?
No.
Representative Josephson?
No.
Representative Hughes?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Colbert?
Yes.
Representative Schultz is not here, and Representative Olson?
Yes.
I have 5 yeas and 3 nays.
The bill moves out of committee. I can do that more officially, but Senate Bill 125 moves out of committee with attached fiscal note and whatever else. Next item on the calendar today is House Bill 372. As members recall, we had a presentation on this bill on March 28th. A new CS has been distributed. Is there a motion to adopt the CS?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move CS HB 372 version 29-L S1379-H as the working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And let's see, Lori Wangheyer is on the line, but Lori, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation and take up where we left off.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Lori Wangheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Before you, you have the CS for House Bill 372. I will walk you through the changes that we've made to the bill in the last week. Beginning on Section 4, which is found on page 3, we have added to the title of Section 4 the words relating to health care insurance policies. This was done to clarify that workers' compensation is not included in the definition of health care insurance policies. We have deleted Section 5 in its entirety. So from here on, the section numbers are going to differ from the rest of the bill that you were presented earlier or last Wednesday. Going further back into the bill.
Point of order.
And we're going to jump.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, just clarification, if I might, that Section 5 that was stripped from the last version, was that the issue over the health care that was brought up, I think, by Representative Hughes?
It was brought up by Representative Hughes, and we're going to talk about it in a minute. It has been moved into the OBGYN section, but only applicable to that section.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Section 31 on the bottom of page 19. There were some concerns that we had asked for a 90-day period to review filings, when the intent was to give us 45 days, as we had, to review filings and then allow the insurers to give 45 days notice of a premium or a form change to the consumer. So we have changed this section, Section 31, by adding the words the specific and the exact change in Section B. When we did that, we then deleted the two sections in the old bill, which would, I believe, were sections 46, and I'm jumping back and forth here, so I apologize, but were then the old bill, section 46 and section 50, where we ask for the 90-day notice of cancellation. But it clarifies that they will give a notice of 45 days to the consumer after they know that the premium or the changes in the form filings. We then added on page, I'm sorry, I missed it, and I'm going to have to ask you to go up to Section 8, and I do apologize to the committee. Section 8, which is on page 7. This is where what was Section 5, this will now apply to OBGYN, and again, this is for the federal preemption. We're putting the words in, a participating down on page line 24, a participating healthcare professional who specializes in the obstetrics or gynecology shall agree to adhere to the healthcare insurer's policies and procedures, including procedures regarding referrals, obtaining prior authorizations, and providing services under a treatment plan, if any, approved by the healthcare insurer. And that is verbatim to get us out of federal preemption. And those, Mr. Chairman, are the changes that we have made to the bill, except for the renumbering that was necessitated by the changes that we made.
Representative Josephson, you got all that?
Yeah, enough. Through the chair, Ms. Wingheyer, the subsection H you were just talking about, you said this allows us to avoid federal preemption. Can you lay that out for me and explain what would happen if we'd been preempted?
I think there's several things that we could face. One, we want to keep the insurance state-based regulation, and that's always been a concern of anyone that you talk to that is an insurance regulator, that insurance is best at the state as opposed to on the federal level. The second is, as we look at healthcare reforms, as we look at different ways of which we can work with the Affordable Care Act, be it a waiver or be it what our next step is in dealing with consumers and being able to provide them better healthcare products, healthcare insurance products, more affordable healthcare products, is being in compliance to go forward with CMS.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you. So to comply with federal law, we have to have this in somewhere. Is it specific to comply with federal law that it be applied to OBGYN docs?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, this particular sentence is verbatim out of the ACA, yes. There's different parts of the bill where we've used substantially similar law, but this particular is, before what we had, we were using substantially similar. And we had many concerns from providers on that language, so we went back to exactly what the ACA was saying.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Have we heard from OBGYN physicians on this provision here in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, no, we're not, because I believe that they knew it. They, by federal, they had to follow it.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And I know you're not a medical provider, so I don't know if you can answer this, but I'm just trying to understand why this particular federal law is wanting this particular provision for OBGYN physicians as opposed to other provider types.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I don't know that I can answer that. We had thought that being the, in reading it, that perhaps the transparency and for the provider to be able to tell the consumer what the insurance was going to pay would be a good thing, because we do receive complaints of for the balance billing and co-pays and the miscommunication between the provider and the insurer. But we did receive a number of complaints or concerns when the bill was introduced. So we deleted Section 5 and put it back to exactly what it came across from the ACA, and did not broaden it at all.
It's similar to the concern that I had before, where I don't want the insurer dictating how a patient is treated. If the insurer were to approve a treatment plan and the patient and physician decided to deviate from that, would the insurer still pay for the part of the plan that was agreed to, and there wouldn't be any penalties for them deviating it for it if the patient were willing to pay for that portion out of his or own, well, it'd be a her pocket, I suppose, if it's OBGYN.
Through the chair, as Representative Hughes, the consumer always has the option to go out of network to have a different procedure than what their insurance will pay for. They always retain that right. But the insurance company retains the right to pay what is written into the benefit plan. And that's what this provision is trying to clarify, is that there would, that the consumer will know up front exactly what they can expect, so there will not be surprise billings. But it's not intended to get in the middle, to have the insurance company get in the middle between the provider and the patient.
New question?
Just follow-up comment. Thank you for that, and I appreciate the change. I still am concerned about the application to the OBGYN physicians, but that's sounds like more of a federal problem than a state problem. It perturbs me that that they would have that require for that subset of physicians.
Representative Ledoux.
So I just want to make sure that I understand this correctly. The old Section 5, in which there were some concerns brought forth by providers, that's now no longer there?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct. We have deleted that section in its entirety.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Ms. Wing-Hire, subsection H, isn't this simply part of the policy and the values of the ACA, that it has the salutary effect of saying women's health care is fundamental, and we're going to make it part and parcel of a general package of primary care? Isn't that all that, just to clarify Representative Hughes's comment, isn't that all that this is doing?
Representative Gelston, through the chair, I wouldn't disagree with you on that, but I would not try to explain exactly what the intent was of the Affordable Care Act when it was written.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson?
No.
Any further questions? Thanks, Kim. Are you going to stay online?
Yes, sir.
I think I will open it up to public testimony if there are no further questions for the director. Ginny Monk, you're in the room, I believe. There you are. Please join us and state your name and affiliation for the record. You have our undivided attention.
Great, thanks. My name is Jeannie Monk, and I am a senior program officer with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Becky Hultberg could not be here today and asked me to provide comments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. HB 372 is a complex bill, and we have had little time to fully understand and vet it. We have heard that the intent is to conform Alaska statutes to federal law and to the National Association of Insurance Commissioner standards, but we don't know which portions of the bill conform to federal law and which are based on the NAIC model. So this has made the analysis a little bit difficult. Originally, we were one of the provider groups that had concerns over Section 5, so that has been deleted from the most recent committee substitute. We appreciate that. That does address a concern we had. Section 5 had mandated that providers include language in their contracts with insurers requiring them to adhere to the insurer's policies and procedures. And policies and procedures typically represent industry operating standards and norms. And this language, however, was not limited to clinical policies and could have significantly and negatively impacted providers' rights to be paid on contractually negotiated reimbursement rates. So removing that language or putting it in a different section where it is closer aligned with the ACA requirement meets our concerns. We do have two remaining areas of concern. Our first concern is Section 11 on page 8. Lines 15 through 22, which defines an emergency medical condition. This definition does not include the prudent layperson standard, which is a standard in federal law for determining the need to visit the emergency room. The standard in federal law establishes the criteria that insurance coverage is based not on diagnosis, but is based on whether a prudent person could anticipate the possibility of serious illness or impairment. So we would encourage the committee to make the definition of emergency medical condition consistent with the definition in the Affordable Care Act. So to look at what is the exact language that is in the Affordable Care Act and match that with this emergency medical condition. Our second remaining concern is Section 32, which is on page 20. And there's two references. One is on line 15 and the other is on line 20. And this section includes new language that adds the term or omits information, two different places, to the definition of a fraudulent insurance act. This addition significantly broadens the insurer's ability to say that any information that they deem relevant that was not included in the claim is material, establishing a fraudulent claim. So we're concerned that adding this language could turn any average bill submission into a fraudulent claim. So we would ask that this language be deleted. I had heard a suggestion that one option would be to add intentionally to it. So either to delete omits information or to make sure it's an intent, because we do not feel people can be responsible for any information that might be omitted. So that's that summarizes our remaining concerns. Given the short time frame we've had to review this really complicated bill, we're happy to work with you to address any of these concerns. So thanks for your work on these issues and your time.
We take some questions.
Sure.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Hughes.
I will try.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill has been interesting. If I can just say something real fast, in that it's sort of overwhelming, but then it's really. As we've gotten into it, I think the committee's been very curious about it and been very interested in it. The Section 11 comment about the prudent layperson standard, mm-hmm. Through the chair, Ms. Monk, is what you're trying to get at that this subsection 15 language, Section 11 of the bill language, is too restrictive? It's too high a standard for the flag football player who thinks he may have broken his wrist, but maybe it's just a sprain and he wants to check it out? Is that sort of where you're going with it?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, that's exactly right. The prudent layperson standard is a lower standard, that it's just what a prudent layperson would do without having gone to medical school or knowing.
Okay.
And so, yeah, matching the federal law, that is the prudent layperson standard.
All right. May I follow up? So as to that section, it sounds like ASHNA's interest is in protecting patient rights. That's what my brain.
That's exactly right. So when a patient comes to the emergency room and they think they're having a heart attack, they don't know what they're just based on a prudent layperson,
right.
Not an actual diagnosis.
Then as to Section 32, my sense is that you're trying to protect the provider, or rather the insurer's rights. Is that your sensitivity there?
I would say with Section 32, we're protecting the person who's submitting an insurance bill.
Okay.
Which could be a patient or it could be a provider.
Okay. And just to follow up.
Oh, sure.
It's a provider if obviously submitted by the provider, and a patient if it's okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
And on that same Section 32, if you look at line 8, where it lays out the situation as far as mm-hmm. the provider presenting a statement that might accidentally omit information, mm-hmm. on line 8 it says the fraudulent insurance act is committed by a person who, with intent to injure, defraud, or deceive. So that intent, I think, is already there. And did you already consider that when you were concerned about the language or omit information?
I did not. It was only actually this afternoon that somebody said, well, maybe if we just added intentionally. So we were originally just concerned with having that section removed. So I would have to consult with others to see if that language addresses. The first glance was no, it did not.
Paula?
And so if you could find that out, if that line 8 and 9 takes care of that, so we'll know, because I certainly wouldn't want a clerical error to put a statement in the category of being fraudulent. Mm-hmm. So let us know on that. Thank you.
Representative Liddell.
I guess I'm just thinking that this new language, this omits information, this just leads to litigation as to whether a claim should be accepted or not. It seems to be just one more basis for an insurance company to deny a claim. And I guess it just sort of seems to me that insurance companies are pretty good denying claims as it is, the status quo.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we would agree, and that was our concern, is we don't want to give any additional ways for claims to be denied. There do seem to be enough.
Commissioner Wenghire, are you still with us?
Here I am.
Any thoughts on page 20? On oral
meds. On page 20, section 32, part of addressing the cost of health care is addressing fraud, and it doesn't matter what line of insurance we're addressing. We're adding that particular or omits information. Representative Hughes was right. It has to have intent to it. Any of the acts listed there have to have intent. It cannot be a simple clerical error. It cannot be just a misstatement. It cannot just be a one-time occurrence. There has to be intent. And it is not about insurance companies failing to pay claims. It is someone who is committing fraud.
Follow-up? Representative Keto, question for Laurie or question for...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a question for Laurie and a follow-up on the previous question. Ms. Wenghire, how would the department define or determine intent in this case? For somebody who is filling out an application, how would the Division of Insurance know that they had not unintentionally filled something out when the insurance company perhaps is saying they intentionally did it?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, we wouldn't look at one claim or one claimant. It would have to be multiples of them filing claims or the provider filing multiple claims against an insurer. It would not be a single incident. There would have to be intent, and we would have to see a pattern before we would even look at it.
Thank you.
Do you have a question on the previous? Nope. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm looking still at Section 32 because I see the word incomplete on line 15. Did that not cover the or omit information?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, no, it did not. There were times where we have had situations where it was not just incomplete. There was information totally lacking.
So they checked the no box instead of the yes box, or...
Mr. Chairman, that's basically what happened, where there was just information that was totally not submitted that was relevant to the claim.
I guess I'm confused why that's incomplete doesn't work. I mean, to me, they're kind of the same. I'm just having trouble wrapping my brain around that one. Incomplete, missing information. Can you explain how those are different?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, incomplete could be that they completed half the form or half the information as opposed to not giving us any on or giving the insurer, in this particular case, any information on what they found as far as the diagnoses or why they completed a certain procedure. Omitting information is as to why they did a certain procedure for someone.
Representative Kito? No. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Let's see. We have Don Hale from the Division of Insurance for questions only in the room. Welcome back, Don.
Thanks, sir.
We have Joe Safada, Alaska Primary Care Association in Anchorage. Are you with us, Joe?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Olson. And members of the committee, my name is John, J-O-N, Zazada, Z-A-S-A-D-A, Policy Director with the Alaska Primary Care Association. Our Executive Director, Nancy Merriman, couldn't be here today. We are the statewide membership organization of Alaska's community health centers. Because our constituency is composed of safety net healthcare providers, our comments on Health Bill 372 focus on the potential impact of this bill on that population. We do appreciate the committee deleting Section 5 in the CS document, and we also were concerned with strengthening the language in Section 32, Section B, subsections 2 and 3 on page 20. And we were the ones that were, you know, suggesting putting the word intentionally in front of omits information in subsections 2 and 3. And we actually did that last week when we were doing our first review of the bill. And we were talking with other community health associations outside of Alaska who had had similar experiences, and that was suggested in conversation with them. So that's where we came up with inserting that word. And other than that, we appreciate the opportunity to testify today and are happy to continue to work with the committee on the completion of the CS document. Thank you.
So at this point in time, the only question you have is intentionally, and that the lines 8 and 9 doesn't clear that up for you?
Yes, sir.
Any questions?
Well,
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I just want to say hi to John and say hi to everybody at the APCA for me, and I was going to ask the same question if you thought that lines 8 and 9 didn't take care of that, and you're saying it does not take care of it as far as you're concerned, lines 8 and 9?
Through the chair, Olson, Representative Hughes, we did think that it makes the section stronger to add the word intentionally. You know, again, we read lines 8 and 9 and still decided that that might be a way to make it crystal clear.
Okay, thank you.
No questions?
Yeah,
Representative Jones?
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Posada, relative to Section 11 and the comment about the prudent layperson standard, do you agree with Ms. Monk that that should be included as I don't know, another part of Section 11, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, because I think, you know, on the basis, yes, we understand, you know, the prudent person you know, concept, but because we don't provide emergency services, it wasn't something that we were really actually even, you know, looking at in the bill. But, you know, on its basis, you know, given other ways we look at the care we provide, yes, we would agree with ASHNA.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Ledoux? No. Thanks again, Mr. Zapata. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify? Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify that hasn't so far? Seeing none and hearing none, we're going to close out public testimony. But I think we're going to hold the bill over until the next meeting and see if we can get the last issue that's hanging out there resolved. And Lori, when do you get back to town?
On Saturday night.
Oh, Saturday night. Okay. I'll give you a call tomorrow and we'll see if we can set something up before then so we can keep it moving.
That'd be fine.
Anyway, thank you for joining us, and with that, we will take a brief at ease. Representative Tammy Wilson presenting House Bill 299. Also, Barbara Barnes from her staff. Do you both want to be at the table, or are you going to do it solo?
I'll do it solo, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for joining us today, and please tell us about the bill. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole. Mr. Chairman, I will learn to come down the steps a lot quicker now, knowing you have a three-minute rule. So with that, HB 299 is being brought forward on behalf of the 501c3 nonprofit corporation volunteer fire departments within the Fairbanks North Star Borough operating as independent contractors. They are currently under contract with the borough to provide emergency response services. Each nonprofit fire department has both full-time paid employees and trained volunteers as emergency responders. Each of these organizations provide benefit plans for all members. Dolan versus King County was a lawsuit between the county and independent nonprofit organizations which provided indigent legal services to the county. Over a period of 30 years, King County asserted increasing budgetary and day-to-day authority over the formerly independent nonprofit organizations. In doing so, it asserted more control over the groups that provided the services. Employees of the organization sued the county for the state employee benefits. They argued that the county's funding and control over their independent organizations essentially made them state employees for the purpose of participating in the public employees retirement system. And under pertinent statutes and common law principles, the Supreme Court agreed that employees of the organizations were employees under state law and as such were entitled to be enrolled in the PERS. HB 299 would clearly define who is eligible for the Public Employees Retirement System of Alaska and give added protection to municipalities against such liability. In times of such fiscal strife, this legislation would encourage the exploration and utilization of cost-effective measures for service and promote independent organizations and business. This bill emphasizes the need, however, to maintain the proprieties of the independent relationship when contracting for the provision of essential public service. And Mr. Chairman, I also want to make sure that the committee is aware that Washington also had to pass a law so this didn't happen again. So they are asking not to be put into the PERS system so that they can remain independent contractors, and they also have their own health and retire systems from with that and their own boards. So with that, that's what the bill does, Mr. Chairman.
So I got to ask a question. How many fire service areas are there like that?
Mr. Chairman, we have five. But we have also heard from Ketchikan as well that has the same issues.
I believe Matsu may as well.
Yeah, well, you have how many road service areas?
Representative Culver, through the chair, approximately 109. Okay. We like our independence.
That's after this committee got rid of a few of them for you, consolidated a few of the smaller ones.
Can always count on you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Anyway, you want to walk us through the sectional? That'll take about a minute or two.
I can do that.
And is this your fiscal note, or is this?
No. Well, we don't, Mr. Chairman, we don't make up our own fiscal notes, so the fiscal note would belong to the. There is a zero fiscal note because, again, they are asking not to be placed in it. Okay, so with a sectional, basically, section one, it just contractors, employees of contractors are excluded from this plan. Section 2 pretty much does the same thing, but we're just adding in on Section 3 a person who is compensated on a contractual or fee basis. Mm-hmm. And just to give you an illustration, we did get a call from the University Fire Service area and whether or not they would be impacted because they are in the public employee retirement system. But the contract for the borough is with the University of Alaska. It is not with the service area. So this bill would have no impact on them whatsoever. This is with those that have their own board, and they are private contractors, and that's what our other service areas. And I think you're correct, Mr. Chairman, Matsu. There's some others around that have private contracts and take care of these services themselves.
Representative Kito.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Mr. Chairman, through the chair, the question I have, I guess, is are these individuals covered under some other kind of retirement plan so that the PERS is not necessary?
Representative Kito, through the chair, yes, they have their own medical and retirement. But even if they didn't, they are not employees of the borough, so they shouldn't qualify even if they didn't. But they do have both retirement and health underneath their own plans.
Follow up. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, so do we have a sense for how many individuals that this might impact? How many individuals are they being covered under PERS then wouldn't be covered under PERS, or what is the situation that is actually trying to be fixed?
Well, Representative Kito, through the chair, what happened in Washington is they had a nonprofit that was providing services, and I don't know whether they had their own or not, but what basically they did is they sued the county and said, although we have a contract with you, we think we're pretty much like employees, and I will give this, the county kept putting them underneath their budget and doing more and more to make them like employees, and so they sued to be underneath their system, which I imagine was a pretty good system, and they won because, again, you know, they were more like employees. Washington has changed their law since then, making a very big distinction between what is a contractor and what is an employee, and that's what this does here, is that this is about contractors. You know, they contract with the municipality, but they are completely separate entities, and there would be no way that they should be qualified employees and therefore would not be eligible for the PERS system.
Thank you.
Representative Joseph.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's one, through the chair, there's one sentence in the sponsor statement that caught my eye a little bit, and it reads, in times of such fiscal strife, this legislation would encourage the exploration and utilization of cost-effective measures for services and promote independent organizations and business. Is this designed in some way to help privatize employees who are now public employees?
Representative Joseph, through the chair, absolutely not. Okay. If they're already employees, they would be. What it states is that this is other ways that you can get services done, possibly, you know, just as efficient and at a cost savings.
Thanks.
Representative Ledoux, you've been noticeably quiet. This is way too easy.
It is that simple, Mr. Chair. It truly is.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify?
I do have a question.
Oh, I got a question. Oh.
I actually
Hughes followed by Colbert.
I was too quiet, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that we're trying to lay this out now and make sure we don't have a problem like Washington did, but has there been any discussion or anything that there was a problem starting to brew here in Alaska, or you're just trying to get ahead of it?
Representative Hughes, to the chair, being proactive is much better and much more affordable.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Colbert.
Yeah, Rep. Wilson, can you walk us through how this works, how they contract with firefighters, how that works?
Representative Colbert, through the chair, we have two things that happen, at least with ours. We have a mill rate that is set for each one of our fire service areas, which is completely separate of the contract. The contractual part with our borough is for EMS. and EMS is based on housing so many ambulances. They get repaid for so many calls that they make, and that's the actual contract that they have with the borough.
Paul?
Yeah, so the EMS service is by a private sector or a 501c3 entity, not housing a borough fire station or facility. It's totally a private sector or a nonprofit.
Representative Colbert, to the chair, no, it is our fire departments. They have two separate things that they do. First of all, they have their fire service protection that they have that's based on a mill rate that's set by those who are in that service area. And then they separately contract with the borough for a different area in which, yes, they do house the ambulances. They have responders that come with that. Some are volunteers, some are paid. But that's the actual contract for EMS service underneath the borough.
Okay, so.
And we do have, I think, a helpline on.
So your EMS is not service area, that's area wide, because you don't have those powers by service area. So the area wide, the borough is contracting with the fire service area to provide those services.
Representative Culver, to the chair, correct.
Okay. And then is there a fire chief or there's a. Head ambulance chief that directs the staff?
Perhaps a culvert through the chair. It's done by the fire chief, but then you also have an EMS director for Better Way of the borough as well.
Okay. So how do they, is there an IRS ruling that they're contractors, these individual EMS providers? We're talking about contractors and employees of contractors excluded from PERS. So, but they have a wage relationship with the fire service area or the EMS provider. They're getting paid by the hour, right? The contractual relationship is just between the borough and the fire service area.
Representative Culver, to the chair, correct.
Okay. Now, this is, Mr. Chair, this is an issue. Yeah, this is an issue that has come up with previous employees. Now, were you aware of any issue of previous employees that were working maybe part-time that have said, well, we think we should be covered by PERS?
Representative Culver, to the chair, no.
Okay.
There's no employees that have come forward because they work. They all have their plan. They believe that they are, which they are, workers of the whatever fire service area they are.
But it's a public entity. I don't know. See, are they part-time or full-time?
Representative, through the chair, they have both. And I also have a lifeline with Chief online.
The reason I asked, Mr. Chair, this issue has come up, and it may be settled litigation, but a number of Metsu Borough, the way they handle it, the EMS staff are hired by the borough, and one of their incentives was if you work so many hours, you could get access to health care. But to avoid paying benefits and retirement, they kept them on part-time status and have a number of them. And some of the other full-time staff, they would end up working a lot of overtime. Well, employees came in and said, well, we have a right to PERS, hired an attorney, and started a legal action against the Metsu Borough. I'm not sure the latest status on that is, but this area of this PERS with the fire department and the EMS employees is a very expensive proposition for a government.
Representative Culver, through the chair, what I'm talking about, these are independent contractors. None of these are employees of the borough itself. What you're speaking of, from what I understand, is you're talking about your borough has actually hired people, and they've kept them on a part-time status so that they would not have to give those kinds. These are hired by our fire service areas as an independent contractor.
And actually, we've had somebody who just came online a couple minutes ago, Fire Chief from Steve's. Mitch Flynn, are you with us?
Yes, I am. My name is Mitch Flynn, Fire Chief with the Steve's Volunteer Fire Department, and we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization in Fairbanks.
So you replaced Jeff Tucker.
And I, Jeff Tucker and I have worked close together. He's actually down in the Kenai area now.
Oh, yeah. And he used to be in Soldotna before that,
yes.
Before you guys even. Please continue your testimony.
Okay. Well, I'll just go ahead and read my prepared statement, then I can answer questions. We are an independent contractor with the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and we provide fire and EMS services within a predefined service area on an annual basis. In recent years, the Fairbanks North Star Borough has brought to our attention problems with the way our contracts have been written that may pose a financial liability risk to our fire and EMS service area taxpaying residents. Legal terms like piercing the corporate veil and doctrine of retained control have been brought up to the local fire departments that have resulted in positive changes to our contracts to help reduce that risk. However, we feel one threat may still be there that could result in our taxpayers being liable for large claims, and that one major possible claim is current or past employees suing for PERS benefits due to the way these contracts were administered in the past. The sole purpose of House Bill 299 is to eliminate that threat to the PERS retirement system and prevent private corporation employees that currently do not receive PERS benefits from suing to receive them. It is not the purpose of this bill for municipal, state, or university fire departments which currently have contractual relationship with boroughs to provide them or to prevent them from fulfilling those contracts. It is also not the purpose of this bill for employees currently eligible for receiving PERS benefits to be removed from the system. I have identified about 6 nonprofit fire departments statewide that contracted municipal governments to provide fire and EMS services to a population base of approximately 75,000 residents. Locally, we have 2 city and 1 university fire department that provide contractual services to the borough who are rightfully in the PERS system and should remain so. Departments such as mine, the Steves Volunteer Fire Department Incorporated, have their own medical retirement benefits program. We're never intended or expected to participate in the state's PERS system. And please support House Bill 299 in protecting the public employee retirement system and those employees that are rightfully entitled to them. And I turn back over to the chair.
Any questions for Chief Flynn? Thank you for joining us today. We also in the room have Katie Lee from the Division of Retirement and Benefits for questions. Anybody have any questions for R&B?
I do.
Please join us.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement Benefits.
Representative Culver, I bet
Thank
you have a question.
Through the chair, Ms. Lee. Is it common for municipal entities to contract out with nonprofits or others and then seek an exclusion from PERS? Do you see any problems with this approach?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, it is common for municipalities to contract out certain aspects of their work. The key from the PERS side is that these independent contractors remain independent. In other words, that the municipality can't start to control their behavior, their finances, or their physical arrangements. Once a municipality starts doing that, then the independent contractor is no longer independent and can be considered an employee.
Okay, so
new question.
Yeah, how does the insurance and the liability issue work? Is there, I guess that's not the wage and retirement area, but let's just ask you about part-time versus full-time. Is there, what's the threshold for where an employee would be entitled to PERS covers under the current tier system? How many hours would they have to work if they're an employee?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, the threshold for part-time service is a minimum of 15 hours regularly scheduled every week. For full-time, they are considered full-time if they work at least 30 hours regularly scheduled per week.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? With that, I'm going to keep public testimony open. I think we've probably got a few more munis that may be weighing in, and we will adjourn at
505.